So this is William Blake's art, and this particular picture, it's actually the top quarter of a picture, is inspired by a verse at the end of Job that says this: while all the morning stars sang for joy and the sons of God shouted together. It's a little bit ironic because one of the stars, angels, is not shouting for joy. He's complaining that God has made the universe wrong. And one of the sons of God is also not shouting for joy. He's asking, why am I suffering like this? God's universe, subtitled Job the Steadfast. Why do we struggle with Job? Why do we struggle with Job? Oh, come on. This worked before. I tested it. Why do we struggle with Job? Let's see if we can get it working. There are a couple of ways we can cheat. Ah, no, the problem is just that I haven't given it priority. So why do we struggle with Job? Why don't we like Job? Why don't we read the book? Karen was pointing out somebody once prophesied over her life that she was like Job. She didn't consider that to be a blessing. Why do we neglect it? Why don't we read it as much as we do some other books? Right, okay, there's this idea that maybe Job is contagious. Maybe if you will read the book, then this is what will happen to you. I'm really not sure it works like that. Any other reasons? It could be depressing. Some people find it depressing. So most Christians don't like Job. One of the reasons is we find it hard to get the big picture of the book. And that's what this evening is about. For some people, the poetry can be really, really hard to decipher. And I struggle with that because for me, the poetry is clear and simple and beautiful. The theme of suffering, do we like suffering? It can be a little bit too painful. The fear that Job's suffering might be contagious, because stuff like this only ever happened in the Old Testament. It never happened in the New Testament, and the New Testament has surpassed Job, and all we get is blessing. Maybe it's the idea of a little bit of a lack of faith. We're frightened that Job didn't have the faith that he should have had. Or perhaps also because parts of the book are genuinely shocking. Job and his friends say some things that are very, very wrong. And they say some fairly harsh things about each other. And they say some fairly harsh things about God. Things get said in Job that you really shouldn't say in the Bible, in church. So Jerome, who translated the Bible into Latin in the 3rd century, something like that, he said that Job was as slippery as an eel. You can't quite get hold of it. Just when you think you figured out what it means, and when you think you know what the book is about, you discover some totally new aspect to the book, and you discover it's more than you thought. He also said that because he was a translator. And Job contains 100 hapexes. You know what a hapex is? The word that's used once in a document. So there are 100 words that are used in Job that are used nowhere else in the Bible, which makes it really quite hard to translate. It's wisdom literature, like Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, and it deals with some big things. It's not about suffering. At least not directly. It's not about how to support people in suffering either. Those themes are peripheral to the book at best. I have to admit at this point that I am a Jobophile. I love the book of Job. I enjoy reading it. And when in my daily reading the book comes to an end, I always feel sorry. I feel it should be longer. If your Christian faith can't take this book, then you are doing it seriously wrong. If your New Testament Christian faith can't cope with this book, if you have to make excuses for it and come up with reasons why it isn't really saying what it is really saying, then you've either misunderstood the book of Job, or you have misunderstood what God is doing on planet Earth today. And that's what hopefully by the end of today we will find out. The book's got some really, really big ideas in it, things that should put our faith into perspective. So we're going to do it in seven parts. Seven parts. It's okay. Some are long, some are short, some we might even skip. Part one, introduction. This is the boring stuff. James, chapter 5. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count them blessed who persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about for him. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. We misquote this because we say, oh, Job was patient. Well, actually, James didn't accuse him of being patient. He accused him of having perseverance. Job wasn't patient. In fact, you'll discover that in the book he describes himself as impatient. That's Job 21, verse 4, if you're interested. What he did have was perseverance. He kept going. He kept going right the way through his suffering. And it's really, really important that he did that, because more was hanging on his success or failure than he had any idea of. More was hanging on his success or failure than most Christians have any idea of. Job, steadfast. The name Job, Eov in Hebrew, means my enemy. And you will find it in Job 13, verse 24, where Job accuses God of being his enemy. He says to God, God, why are you treating me like your enemy? So that's what the name means. We don't know when or where it was written. We don't know who wrote it. We do know when the story is set. And we also know that the story of Job predates the book of Job. So before this was ever written down, before we ever have it the way we've got it in the Bible, it was already a story that people knew. Think of the way that Disney has a habit of making movies on stories that everybody already knows. So the way of life that Job lives is very clearly a patriarchal way of life. So think Noah, think Enoch, think Abraham, think Genesis setting. The way that he sacrifices for his family, the way that he lives, the kind of flocks and herds that he has, the way that there are raiding parties coming through, it's all very Genesis. His life, length of life of 140 years is very Genesis. In fact, the name us appears in Abraham's genealogy. So there's kind of a direct connection to Genesis. The book makes no mention of any of the things that we expect to find in the Bible. It makes no mention of covenant. It makes no mention of Israel. It makes no mention of any of the things that every other book in the First Testament mentions. No geographical keys, no chronological keys. It's almost like the book is intended to be universal. And to an extent, we're supposed to understand it that way. There are a couple of times when it quotes other books in the Bible. So Job will say, what are human beings that you are mindful of them? And you'll find exactly the same verse in Psalm chapter 8. But in Psalm chapter 8, it's a positive thing. Wow, God, what are human beings that you care so much for us? And in Job, it's negative. What are human beings that you care so much for us? Won't you just look away from us for one moment and leave us alone? Now, we don't know which was quoting which. We don't know whether Job is quoting Psalms or Psalms is quoting Job. And there's another verse like that in Jeremiah. Some people have suggested that it's the oldest book in the Bible. And although in its written form it probably isn't, it certainly is in its contents. We are supposed to think Genesis. We don't know who the author was. Some people will suggest Abraham. Some people will suggest Jeremiah. We don't know. We do know that whoever the author was, he must have suffered. He must have found deep truths about God that were not common in his day. And in his suffering, he must have found God. So whoever the author of the book is, it's pretty clear that a chunk of it is autobiographical. He's writing, at least in part, his own story. Most people think of the book as a theodicy. And a theodicy is a defense of God. So the book answers questions like, why do the righteous suffer? Is God just? Can a person really understand God? Can a person be righteous before God? Does our righteousness please God? Job actually asks that question. What is it to you, whether I sin or whether I don't sin? Why does God allow evil? Why does God allow suffering? Why is the world the way it is? Human misery is only a problem for those of us that believe in an all-powerful God. If you either believe in a not all-powerful God or you don't believe in God at all, suffering shouldn't be a problem for you. Which is why I find it very rich when atheists say things like, this isn't fair. Well, fair assumes somebody that decrees fair. Job takes place within the household of faith. So everybody in the book believes. Everybody in the book wants to please God and to seek him. And although to an extent Job is a theodicy, it's not really. In fact, somebody published a book about 10 years ago explaining why Job was the opposite of a theodicy, because it seemed to dismiss all the answers that people usually give. Are you bored yet? I'll do my best. Structure is important in every book in the Bible, and especially in Job. It's got a very tight structure. So the first two chapters are prose. That means they're narrative. They're a story. The last chapter is also prose. But the big part of the book, the majority of the book, is written in poetry, just like Psalms or Isaiah. And the way they connect together is really interesting, because there are some really big differences between the story at the beginning and the end and the poetry in the middle. So for example, in the narrative, in the prose, God is referred to as Yahweh, or he's referred to as El, but he never gets those names in the poetry. In the poetry, he is Elohim, or Elohei, which is the poetic singular of Elohim, or he's Shaddai. The book likes the name Shaddai. In the story, there is Satan and there is the wife, and both the Satan and the wife disappear in the poetry. You seem to think that was at the beginning of the book. Job is patient and he's righteous, But when you get into the poetry, he's self-righteous and he's defiant. He actually gets quite angry at God. In the prose, he trusts God, and in the poetry, he questions God. But there are other things that go across between the two. So what happens to Job's children is discussed in the poetry. And the fact that he is blameless, that we're told at the beginning of the book, is also critical to understanding the poetry. So the bottom line is, anybody with a healing ministry in the house that can pray for Grant, that's good. So the poetry and the prose need each other. They speak to each other. It is one of my pains of the evening that we're not going to get time to do much of the poetry. There's more structure. So in the first two chapters of the book, there are four speeches. God speaks, Satan speaks. God speaks, Satan speaks. In the end of the book, when we move back into narrative, there are four speeches. God speaks, Job speaks. God speaks, Job speaks. In fact, the book likes pause, just like Revelation likes pause. In the poetry, there are three cycles of dialogue. So Job has three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad the Hobbit. I wonder where that's where Tolkien got the idea for the name from. And Zophar. Zophar, so good. So each of them have a speech, and Job responds to each. Then, a little bit later on, a fourth friend, who's been there the whole time, comes onto the scene. He's younger than everybody else. That might be important. And he gives four speeches. So here's the overall structure of the book. Prologue, first two chapters. Then we get Job's lament, which has gone off the screen. Job's lament is sometimes called his soliloquy. It's the first bit of poetry in the book, and basically Job just expresses his grief. Then we get all three friends and Job doing their first argument, then we get the second argument, then we get the third argument. Then we get this really weird verse, this really weird chapter. It's chapter 28, and most scholars today consider it to be critical to understanding the book. It's called the Discourse on Wisdom. And then Job gives a final defense, and then Elihu speaks, and then God speaks. Then we have an epilogue where everything gets put right. I don't like the epilogue. That's the structure of the book. Now we need to tell the story. This is more of William Blake's art. And this is Satan pouring out affliction on Job. In my imagination, Satan usually wears more clothes, but then I could be wrong. No hooves. That's probably a positive thing. William Blake wrote Jerusalem, and did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's pastures green? He wrote Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night, which is one of my favorite poems. He's an interesting character, a weird character. Question, how is Job described? In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil. He had seven sons and three daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys. He had a large number of servants, and he was the greatest man amongst all the people of the East. You can see why I'm saying this sounds like Abraham, or probably, for that matter, Enoch. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays. It's okay to celebrate birthdays. and they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When the period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned by cursing God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. So what's Job described as? What's he like? He is insanely wealthy. Anything else? He is, well, at least his children were party people. They did party. He's blameless. Now, blameless here is, in Hebrew, it's the word pure, and it doesn't necessarily mean sinless. In fact, you will discover in the book, Job admits to sin, on at least two occasions that I can think of. When we look at him as being blameless, we tend to sort of think, well, yeah, that means he's forgiven, and we tend to sort of jump into the New Testament and start thinking about Christ and the cross, because this is how a person gets to be blameless. But that's not what Job is doing. We'll find out what Job is doing in a minute. He's upright. He fears God. He shuns evil. He's a family man. He's a rich man. And he is a genuinely religious man. Too religious? Little bit paranoid? Little bit frightened that if his kids do the wrong thing, the whole house of cards that he's built as his life is going to come crumbling down? Perhaps he fears God a little bit in the wrong way. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth, going backwards and forth on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replies. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? Have you not blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds spread out through the land? Now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. The book revolves around a single question. It is a question that God asks. "Have you considered my servant Job?" It is pretty clear that God considers Job to be an example of something. It is also pretty clear that Satan believes him to be an example as well. So who starts this debate? It's God. God starts it. Who brings up Job as an example? And if you are, it's not Satan, it's God. "Have you considered my servant Job?" I desperately hope that God never says in the heavenly courts, "Have you considered my servant Ray?" Satan then makes a claim about Job. He says, "The only reason that Job serves you, God, is because you've blessed him. It's because you've put a hedge around. And he only loves you, and he only serves you, and he's only righteous because you've bribed him." So the question is, why does Job serve God? And If Satan is correct, well, we'll come to that in a moment. So the question here is, in the book, who's being tested? Is it God? Is it Satan? Or is it Job? Well, it's all of them. It is all of them, isn't it? But you'll realize that it's predominantly an issue between God and Satan. And Job, well, again, we'll come to that in a minute. In this book, God stands to lose something. If Job can't be faithful, if the Satan is right, then there's a real problem here. And one of the things that becomes very clear as you understand the book and you move through it is that God has an insane faith in Job. He really believes in Job. It's often said, you know, I believe in God, but God believes in me. And it's pretty clear that God has a higher idea of Job than Job has of himself. It's really quite exciting, because I think the same might be true of us. So the question here, why do you serve God? I mean, why do you serve God? Do you just serve God so that he will bless you? Do you just serve God so that he will protect you? Do you serve him for what you can get out of it? Can you begin to see where the book is going? So in Job, Satan is a title, not a name. So in the Hebrew, it is always Ha-Satan, the Satan. You'll already have heard me say it once. Because he is, well, the word Satan in Hebrew means accuser. So he is the accuser of the brothers and sisters. So if you're wondering what he's doing in this heavenly council when all the angels are there, he's fulfilling his role. And he's accusing. He's accusing the brothers and the sisters, us. You'll find the same thing in Zechariah chapter 3. It's a very similar kind of a deal. So the argument in Job is between God and the Satan. Both God and the Satan believe that Job proves their case. So what does that make Job? The meat in the sandwich. It makes him the test case. That's what it makes him. He is the test case. And to that extent, you will realize that Job is us. He's an individual, but he is humanity as a whole. So if Job fails, if it turns out that the only reason that Job does serve God is because God gives him nice toys to play with, who wins? See what I mean when I say that God has something to lose in the book? See what I mean when I say that God has this insane belief that Job will stand strong under persecution? The question is not just why does Job serve God. It's probably more than that. In all likelihood, Satan goes further than this. You're wrong in making humankind the way you have. You're wrong in giving them free will and the ability to sin. That was a stupid idea in the first place. You're wrong in making this flesh and blood animals have a real spirit. These human beings, they're some kind of a hybrid. They're not pure spirits like us, says the Satan. Half flesh, half human. You'll realize that the conflict between God and Satan is not a conflict of power, because God is all-powerful and the Satan isn't. And if he wanted to, God could snap his fingers and Satan would disappear in a puff of smoke. Most of us would be very happy for that to happen. So why doesn't God do that? Well, God doesn't do that because it's not a power debate. It is an argument debate. And if Janine and I get into an argument, and the only way I can win that argument is to deck her, have I won the argument? In fact, I've done the opposite, haven't I? So you'll realize that the only answer that God has to Satan's accusation is to stop him from existing. God loses the argument. Hence, Job. So how does this get fixed? Job is a test case. If he chooses to be loyal to God, then God wins. But if he ends up being disloyal to God, the Satan wins. And God thinks Job proves his case, and the Satan thinks that Job proves his case. Job is the test case for what God is doing with humans. So we need to look at Job very closely. This is an awesome quote. And it's a quote that's made in a book that is aimed at congregations, not at academics. Although the guy writing it is a serious academic, responsible for one of the major series of commentaries. If man, the only creature God made with the capacity to love, does not love God genuinely and of a free will, then God's purpose in creation has failed. So the only way that God can get love from his creatures is to not give them the freedom to hate him, or to bribe them the way that the Satan suggests. Then all that God's done in creation comes to a grinding halt. Now we've got to take a quick look at Job's innocence. But the very, very first thing we're told about Job is that he is blameless, that he is upright. And we are being told something very specific. Because whatever happens from here on in the book, and spoiler alert, it's going to get pretty gruesome. Whatever happens from here on in, whatever might happen to Job, however he might suffer, the one thing we know that did not cause it is his sin, because he's blameless. Now his friends are going to accuse him of this. They're going to say the reason that you're suffering is because you are a sinner. And they genuinely believe that, but we can't believe that. We've been given secret knowledge. We know that Job's suffering does not come because of his sin. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the older brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them, and they put your servants to the sword. I am the only one to escape to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "Fire of God fell from sky and burnt up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them and put your servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine in the older brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house, and it collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." You'll notice there are four incidents. You will notice they alternate between human causes and divine causes. At this, Job tore his robe and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshipped. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. So what's Job's response to his first loss? Come on, you can do this. He worships. Well, the first thing he does is he mourns. Rips his clothes, hair, but then he worships. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. And we can argue about whether that's true or not. Some people who want to read this from a New Testament perspective say this isn't really true. And I want to say that having done many, many funerals, I have never buried a naked person. And nobody that I know has gone to the grave naked. He doesn't do what Satan predicted. He doesn't curse God. He turns around and blesses God. So what's the score? Who's winning? God is winning. It is 1-0 to God. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and the Satan also came to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, we might have heard this before, where have you come from? And the Satan answered, oh, from roaming through the earth, from going back and forth on it. And the Lord said to the Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains his integrity. Notice for God how important it is that he maintains his integrity. Though you incite me against him to ruin him without cause. Skin for skin, the Satan replied. A man will give all he has for his own life. Stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to the Satan, very well, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life. The Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head. What's Satan's argument this time? What's the argument? Right, it's only what touches him personally. It doesn't matter to him that he's lost everything. It's basically the same argument as before, but just on a personal level. So this second loss, how does Job respond? Well, he says to his wife, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Just out of interest, who does Job blame for the trouble that he's in? Because there is no indication in the book that he has any knowledge of Satan whatsoever. I'll move back on that a little bit later. Who does he blame? He puts the responsibility on God. And we don't like doing that. We want to say, no, it wasn't God, it was Satan. It was Satan that did it, it wasn't God. Well, we'll take a look at that in a minute. What's the score? 2-0. When he lost everything he had, he still worshipped God. When he got his own health disintegrates, he still stays faithful to God. It might become important later on to know who's winning. Is God responsible? We can say that God allowed what happened, but that Satan caused it. The problem with believing in one God and monotheism is that ultimately everything comes back to God. And whatever Satan could do, he could only do because God allowed it. The blame, the buck, stops at God's desk. We struggle with that. God does not. So why does God allow this test? example, I will suggest later on that he allows this test because it is an inevitable part of what God is doing on this planet. The Lord said to the Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? He still maintains his integrity. Go you incite me against him to ruin him without reason." God takes the blame. The next thing we get is Job's soliloquy, and I'd love to read it because it's really cool. And in it, he curses the day of his birth. He says, "I wish I had never been born. I wish there had never been somebody to grab hold of me when I came forth from my mother. I wish nobody had fed me. I wish I'd been stillborn." And in Job's world, in an ancient world, that was a truly shocking thing to say. And he says in the middle of this soliloquy, "What I dreaded has come upon me." And that gets quoted a lot. What was it that Job feared? What do you think? I've already suggested that maybe he feared that this house of cards that was his life, all his blessing, might come crumbling down. Did he fear poverty and pain? Did he fear that he would sin beyond recovery the way that he feared his children might? Did he fear that God would abandon him? Did he fear that all that he'd received from God was too good to be true? Did he fear that God didn't have his best intentions at heart? Did he fear that God's goodness was not as free and abundant as he thought? You will realize that as the book goes on, Job grows in his understanding of God. He goes from a very two-dimensional God to a real three-dimensional God who can be trusted. So Job has faced two temptations, two persecutions. Now he will face two temptations. The first temptation will be posed by his wife. And his wife will say to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die." So what does Job's wife want him to do? Give up. Say, "Okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to curse God. I'm going to tell God what I think about him and blow the consequences." When your wife suggests that you die, you know you're in trouble. If Job does this, who wins? Because if he loses everything he has and his response is to curse God and die, Satan is right. So Job can't do this. The second temptation is a temptation posed by his friends. Appease God and be blessed. "Job, I know that you don't think you sin. I know that you keep telling us that you haven't sinned, or at least you haven't sinned badly enough to receive what you're receiving. But just make it up. Just say whatever you've got to say to God to get him to bless you again. Make up a sin." If he does that, who wins? You see the problem? Because again, it's evidence that the only reason he loves God is because God gives him choice. Because God blesses him. And if that's the case, Satan is correct. That's why it's really important all the way through that Job maintains his integrity. He is the only person on the planet who's not allowed to repent. At this point, the Satan disappears from the book. The book is not about him. Part 3. How we doing? Good. The arguments. Now we get into the poetry. And if I were lecturing this at Bible school, we would really open the book and we would actually go through some of the significant passages. And I would say to the students, as there is a piece of poetry on stage, on screen, about reeds growing where there is water. I would ask the students what that meant, and they would look at me blankly. And it's so obvious to me, it used to frustrate me every year. By the way, the reeds growing where there's water is cause and effect. If you're suffering, you sin. Reeds don't grow where there's no water. There's no smoke without fire. The poetry is absolutely beautiful. And Job's friends go on to explain what is wrong with Job. And each of them, Job responds to each of them. Only he doesn't. They talk past each other. In fact, most of the time, Job talks to God. He doesn't even talk to his friends. And with each round, it gets more and more serious. So it starts quite civil. They're quite nice to Job to start off with. And then by the end, there's blood on the ground when they get pretty ugly and they say some pretty ugly things. Each friend has a different approach. But for each of them, the argument is the same. So this is William Blake's Job's friends accusing him. And again, can we have some more clothes? Eliphaz is the voice of experience. He speaks about what he knows, what he sees. Bildad is a traditionalist. He speaks about what everybody knows. Zohar is the dogmatist. He's the one, this is the truth. And they all say the same things, but each of them approaches it from a different perspective. Wish we had time to go into it. The friend's basic argument is this. You are suffering. That can only mean you've sinned. The solution, you need to repent, and then you will be wealthy again. Satan will be right, because you will only have repented so that God will bless you, but at least you'll be happy. Job's argument is God is treating me unfairly. I don't deserve what I'm getting. God needs to recognize my innocence and stop oppressing me. Yes, he really does say those things. In fact, God points that out at the end because he talks about who is this that obscures my counsel with dark words. Behind all of this is an idea called common theology. I've talked about this before. And common theology is what everybody in the ancient world believed. You get what you deserve. So basically it means that if you're suffering, you sin. And it means that if you're prospering, you're righteous. And as I pointed out, if you follow that idea, that makes people like Bill Gates and Elon Musk the most righteous people on the planet. I am going to come out and say it. They are not. They are not the most righteous people on the planet. I'm not saying that Bill Gates is the Antichrist, right? But maybe he's a type of the Antichrist. I don't know. I don't like Windows. I don't use Windows. That's why we're having trouble this evening, because it's a Windows machine. Bill is against me. Sometimes we call this retribution. I'm going to use that on some slides coming up. It's the same thing. Or in church circles today, we call it the law of sowing and reaping. Now, we believe in sowing and reaping, but we don't believe in the law of sowing and reaping. Because according to the law of sowing and reaping, you guys are all going to hell. Not me, because I don't believe in it. Sowing and reaping, that is. The whole point of the gospel is that you don't get what you deserve. The whole point of the gospel is that Jesus took what you deserve. He reaped what you sowed. And the whole point of the gospel is that you reaped what he sowed. You got his righteousness. So this is not something that we believe, although it still gets taught in church. So Job and his friends all talk past each other. In chapter 28, we get this incredible image. The metaphor is a mine being dug into the earth. And people suspending on ropes go down into this mine and they dig out precious stones and gold. And it's about human technology and our ability to conquer the world and to do incredible things. And it says you can mine for gold and stones, but you won't find wisdom this way. Wisdom belongs to God. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It's an amazing passage. And one of the things we're being told in this is in everything that the friends have said, and in much of what Job has said, we have not yet heard wisdom. Wisdom is going to come with a young man called Elihu. Now, Elihu is an interesting name. It means he is God. And basically what he's doing is he's preparing for God's speech at the end. And there are all kinds of connections between what he says and God's speech. And Elihu's argument is this: God is just and above question. That's what he says to Job. You don't question God's righteousness. God never does anything shoddy or wrong. To his friends, he says, you keep telling us that Job has sinned and that's why he's suffering, but none of you have been able to show him what he's done wrong. So, if that's the case, you better prove what he's done wrong. And they can't. And Job, he says, you've got to trust God. You've just got to trust God. So the book presents three truths. God is just. Job is innocent. Common theology, you reap what you sow. If you're suffering, it's because you sinned, is true. Three truths. The problem is that within the book, not all of those can be true. You can have two of them, but you can't have three of them. So what happens is that Job's three friends, Job and Elihu, each of them champion one of those arguments. Each of them believes another one, and each of them rejects one. It goes like this. Job champions the fact that he's innocent, and he does that the whole way through. I'm innocent, says Job. I haven't sinned. He believes retribution. He believes that you get what you sow. He just doesn't believe it's true for him. He believes that he's this abnormality in the whole of history who didn't get what he deserved. And he rejects God's justice. God picks him up for that later on. Job's friends, they champion retribution. Job, what you're getting is what you deserve because you've sinned. They believe that God is just, so they reject Job's innocence. Elihu champions God's justice. God is just above all, says Elihu. He believes that Job is innocent, so he rejects retribution. He rejects cause and effect. That evil people suffer, good people are blessed. These are the three approaches you can have to the book. Who are you going with? Job, Elihu, or his friends? If you get this wrong, I will lecture you until midnight, until you see it my way. Elihu is right. Elihu is right. God is just above all. Job is blameless. It's the first thing we were told in the book. Therefore, retribution is wrong. If you understand this in global terms, Job's three friends are what everybody in the ancient world believed. Elihu, the young upstart that doesn't want to speak because he's too young and recognizes the wisdom of everybody else, is Israel. With a new and different understanding about who God is. The understanding that we have. Because we believe in grace. We believe in a God who can bless outside of the rules of blessing and cursing. We believe in a God that can bless us when we don't deserve it. We believe in a God who can give us what we don't deserve. One of the questions that often gets asked is what causes suffering. There aren't many differences between the First Testament and the New Testament, but this is an interesting one, because this is a question that the First Testament is obsessed with. Why do people suffer? The New Testament doesn't ask that question. Like I said, the book of Job changes the question. And it asks the question, what does suffering cause? What does suffering achieve in our lives? And if you read Paul, or you read Peter, or you read James, you will discover it achieves a great deal in our lives. It changes who we are, and not for bad, but for good. Right, we've got some quick ones to go through. We're doing all right. We quarter of an hour, we should be finished. Are you happy? Excellent. The book starts with the heavenly court. It starts with God and the angels and the Satan, and a dispute between God and the Satan. Job believes that God is treating him unfairly. He believes that he is the exception, who, even though he is righteous, is being punished. And he has this idea that maybe if he could appear in that holy council, he could plead his case to God and say, God, I am being mistreated here. The theologians call this the riv. That says riv. Can you see it? The riv. And a riv in the Bible is a legal dispute. So when Abraham and Lot's shepherds argue, that is a riv. It's a legal dispute. Job wants to take God to court. To start off with, he recognizes that this could never happen. He recognizes that if he actually appeared before God, he wouldn't be able to say anything, because God is God and he's nothing. I mean, since I'm already found guilty, why should I struggle in vain? Even if I washed myself with soap and my friends and my hands with cleansing powder, you would plunge me into the slime pit so that even my clothes would detest me. By the way, it turns out that my clothes detest me also, but for totally different reasons. They say I've got no fashion sense. What he's saying here is fairly obvious. He's saying, look, I think I'm righteous, but if I were to stand in front of a righteous God, all I would see is my own evil. So me appearing before God isn't going to achieve what I want. He is not a mere mortal like you and me that I might answer him, or that we might confront each other in court. Only there was someone to arbitrate between us, to lay a hand on us both, someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no longer. Now, I mentioned earlier that I don't think that Job knew of the presence of the Satan. But what he's asking for here is someone to stand opposed to the Satan. So if he has an accuser, what he wants is an advocate. He wants somebody to plead his case on his behalf. Somebody who can appear before God and say, Job is innocent. How are your New Testament minds turning? Are you getting the picture? Are you getting where this fits into what we believe? Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways before his face. Indeed, this would turn out for my deliverance, for no godless person would dare to come before him. And you can see in this his response to Satan. Okay, God, whatever you do in my life, I'm still going to trust you. Whatever happens to me, for good or for evil, I'm going to trust you just the same. I'm not in this for the toys. I'm in this because you're God, and that's the right response for me to have to you. So even though you kill me, I'm still going to trust you. I'm still going to obey you. We'll keep going for the sake of time. If I could turn my page. If only there was someone to arbitrate between us. Only there was somebody to appear before God. The word that he uses for arbitrate here, one of the words that he uses. I know that my Redeemer lives, is the word Goel. And for us, we have a Goel. We have one who intercedes for the Father on our behalf, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. So the book is kind of prefiguring who Jesus is going to be. It's really cool. So he starts off by thinking that all this is impossible. But as the book goes on, he gets more and more confident that yes, he will appear before God and he will plead his case. And this isn't just pie in the sky, this is real and it can happen. And the irony is, at the end of the book, that's exactly what happens, and God appears to him and says, okay, Job, tell me. And having asked for this the whole way through the book, it takes Job by complete surprise. It's really quite amusing. Even now, my witness is in heaven, my advocate is on high. He is looking for a redeemer that sounds very much like Jesus. The next thing the book grapples with is resurrection. And you'll realize that both of these are Job's ways of dealing with what he's going through. The first is to say, I need to appear before God so that I can be found. And the second is to realize that if he doesn't get justice in this life, he'll get justice elsewhere. Forgive me for taking the time to read some of the most beautiful poetry in the Bible. He's talking about the resurrection. And you will notice that he starts off by saying that he does not believe such a thing is possible. And he ends up by saying, actually, this is mortals born of woman are a few days and full of trouble. They spring up like the flower and wither away. Like fleeting shadows they do not endure. Why do you fix your eyes on them? Will you bring them before you for judgment? Who can bring what is pure from what is impure? No one. A person's days are determined. You have decreed the number of months and set a limit that they cannot exceed. So look away from him and let him alone until he has put in his time as a hired laborer. God, why do you look at humans so much? Don't you realize what we are? Don't you realize we're dust? Look away from us. At least there's hope of a tree. If it's cut down, it will sprout again, and its new shoots won't fail. Its roots may grow old in the ground, and its stump die in the soil, yet at the scent of water, literally the smell of water, it will bud and put forth shoots like a plant. You can't kill a tree, says Job. Trees just come back. But man dies and is laid low. He breathes his last and is no more. As the waters of a lake dry up or the riverbed becomes parched and dry, so he lies down and does not rise till the heavens are no more. People will not awaken or be aroused from their sleep. There is no resurrection. If only you would hide me in the grave. Conceal me till your anger has passed. If only you would set a time and then remember me. If someone dies, will they live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait for my renewal to come. And you will call and I will answer you. And you will long for the creatures your hand has made. Surely then you will count my steps and not keep track of my sins. My offense will be sealed in a bag, and you will cover over my sin. And it's like he's pulled, screaming and complaining to a belief in the resurrection that ultimately there will be justice. And even though he dies, God will call and he will answer. And it follows the same pattern as the legal dispute. He starts off thinking this is impossible and ends up believing it firmly. I know that my Redeemer lives and that he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, not another. My heart yearns within me. So ultimately, he will be resurrected. God gets two speeches. This is William Blake's God, surrounded by angels. You can't see it, but there are a ring of angels surrounding God flying. It's really cool. It's very Isaiah chapter 6. God speaks from the storm that Elihu predicts is coming. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm and said, "Who is it that obscures my plans with words without knowledge?" Job, you don't know what you're talking about. "Prepare to defend yourself," right? "I'm ready to meet you in court," says God. "I will question you and you will answer me. Were you there when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. On what were its footings set? Who laid its cornerstone? While all the morning stars sang together and the angels, or the sons of God, shouted for joy." I would love to go on and read all of this, but I'm not going to. So please go home and read it. It is the most beautiful poetry. What is really difficult here is to know what kind of an answer it is that God's given to Job's suffering. The famous author Bernard Shaw says, "If I complain that I am suffering, it is no answer to say, can I make a hippopotamus?" I don't think Bernard Shaw understood the book. So how does this help? What God is saying is this: I made the world exactly the way it needs to be. I made a world in which people can genuinely choose to follow me, whether I bless them or whether I don't bless them, in good or bad, in sickness or in health. This is the world in which I succeed. This is the world in which humankind freely come to me and we have a relationship together. I made the world, Job, exactly the way it needs to be. I am mostly a Molinist, and part of what Molinists believe is that God could have created a billion, 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 billion different worlds. God could have created a world in which I was good looking. God could have created a world in which I was skinny. He created this world. He created this world. And if he could have created a billion other worlds and he created this world, why did he do that? Why did he create this world? Well, he created this world because this is the world of perfect balance. This is the world where there is the least suffering and the least grief and the least war for the most number of people before the throne when it all wraps up in Revelation. Every tribe and tongue and nation. A group of people that nobody could count. It's beyond the Greek language to count, because the Greek uses its maximums for angels in the previous chapter. This is the world in which God achieves what he's trying to do. And that is really cool. And when you understand that, the griefs and the problems of this world don't seem quite the same. How does Job respond? The Lord said to Job, "Will you contend with the Almighty and correct him? Do you really think you know better than me, Job? Let the one who accuses God answer him." Then Job answered the Lord, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say nothing." I'll paraphrase that. "I think I'll shut up now," says Job. The second speech, these are Behemoth and Leviathan, the two, Leviathan certainly the chaos monster. We're still not quite sure what Behemoth is, trunk like a tail. We won't get into dinosaurs, although that's a serious possibility. These are some sort of supernatural creatures, and they're the forces of evil in the world. And God says to Job, "Do you really think you can catch Leviathan with a hook and give him to your children to play with? Do you really think you can do that?" "It's me," says God. "I'm the one who restrains evil and chaos in this world. What you can't do, I do. So prepare to defend yourself. I will question you and you will answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God? Do you have a voice that can thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath and look at all who are proud and bring them low. Look at those who are proud and humble them. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. You think you could handle this world better than me? You think that I'm unjust in the way that I treat people? You accuse that those who do wickedness get away with it? Do you think you could do better? God will go on to explain that actually he has put restraint around evil in the world. Have you seen the movie Bruce Almighty? So I've never actually seen the movie, so I'm talking out of ignorance here. But basically, God's response is the Bruce Almighty response. You think you can do better than me? Try. You might find it's harder than you thought. Again, God is saying, I've made this world exactly the way that it needs to be. And Job responds the same way that he did before. The question that the Satan asks God is a real question. Imagine we could run the world differently. Imagine that tomorrow I could walk into my cattle hospital, go around and pray for each sick person, and they would recover. It would, wouldn't it? It would be really cool. And imagine that somebody else up in Auckland would go into one of the hospitals up there, and imagine across the world, what would happen? We'd have a revival, wouldn't we? But what sort of revival? A revival of people that genuinely trusted God, or a revival of people that had no choice? What if in our world it was only the righteous that ever prospered, and Bill Gates was a pauper on the street? What if, we'd have a revival, wouldn't we? Why? Because that's the only way people would get what they wanted. You see the problem that God's got. You see why he made the world the way it is. And when I think this through, God actually blesses far more than I would expect him to. And he heals far more than I would expect him to. So, that's not the right thing. How's Satan defeated? Oh, we all know that, don't we? Satan is defeated on the cross of Jesus, right? We got that. But in the book of Job, how is the Satan defeated? He's defeated when Job stays strong. If man, the only creature that God made with a capacity to love, does not love God genuinely of a free will, then God's purpose in creation has failed. And when Job, with everything stacked against him, will maintain his faith in God, for Satan is defeated. And all it took was one man. All it takes is one for Satan to be crippled. But it's not one. It's millions of us. It's millions of us. I won't say billions, because many of us, when we face persecution, we don't make the right decision. Today, 13 people will die for their faith in Jesus. For most of them, all they have to do is say, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, which is how you become a Muslim. And their life is spared. And they won't do it. They won't do it for the same reasons that Job wouldn't. And Satan is defeated. In our lives, the Satan is defeated. And if you don't believe me, that's not the verse I want. His intention was now through the church, the manifold wisdom of God should be made known to rulers and authorities in heavenly places. I.e., he is proving to spiritual forces, both righteous and unrighteous, that God was right in everything he did through us. The verse I was looking for was one from Paul that says, very shortly, God will crush Satan under Jesus' feet, under our feet, when we stay true, when we obey, when we love God, even though we have no reason to do so, Satan is defeated. I don't like the epilogue. Oh, thank you, William Blake, for giving us some quotes. Thank you. Job admits he's wrong. He gets to intercede for the friends because the friends have got their theology completely wrong. And God is more concerned about the friends having bad theology than he is Job speaking bad things about him. One of the things you will discover about Job is he doesn't say bad things about God. He says bad things to God. And there is a difference. And he makes intercession for his friends, and in the end, he ends up with double everything he had before. Robinson says this: we would rather have left Job on the dung heap with his faith shining all the more brightly against the background of his fortune. I sympathize with that view. I'm kind of pleased that Job had a happy ending. But the ending doesn't matter. So this is a meta-parable. This is a story about what God is doing in creation, what he's doing in the fall, what he's doing in salvation. And you are a part of this. You are the Job that stays faithful to God, even when everything is impossible for you. And the battle's already won. It only took one person. But every time you stay faithful, the Satan is defeated. So you're going to read the book of Job? You're going to try and understand the poetry? If you ask me nicely, I've written a paraphrase of each of the arguments. It will take me a while to dig them out, but maybe I can. Maybe that will help you to read it. But especially read those last chapters. Read what God says, because the poetry is stunning. The ideas are incredible. Any questions?